Hi, Christina. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing really good. Doing really good. I'm in Boston now. I'm doing a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, and it's really going fantastically.
Oh, awesome. Maybe you should we introduce ourselves?
Oh, we probably should. Yeah, because I guess this has been.
You want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I'm Maggie Kurth Baker. I'm a science journalist and a Nieman Berkman Fellow at Harvard University.
And I'm Christina Agapakis. I'm a biologist and a science writer and sometimes an artist.
Sometimes an artist. I think I must have missed that in our last conversations. What are you doing with art?
I think in our last conversation we talked about my sort of big art project about cheese. And then these days I'm teaching at the Art Center College of Design in Los Angeles, or in Pasadena. And I sort of am really interested in how artists and designers can work with scientists and engineers to do all sorts of projects together. So that's a big part of the work that I do right now. We can
Cool.
talk about that more later.
Yeah, let's do.
But tell me more about the Nieman Fellowship. What sort of for people who don't know what it is and that sort of thing.
Well, what I love about the Nieman Fellowship is that it's kind of I get to take a year off. I have no deliverable at the end of this year. I don't have anything I technically have to be doing. The requirements that are put on me are like the most amazing requirements ever. I have to audit one class at Harvard or MIT every semester, at least one. I can do more. I have to show up for these really amazing seminars that we have. So, like, we had Pussy Riot in a couple weeks ago, and we had, who else have we had? We had a guy who does stem cell research last night. We have had Jill Abramson, who used to be the editor at the New York Times. We've had Jill Lepore, who is my enduring girl crush, and just incredible speakers come to talk to us. And that's the stuff that I have to go do, is have to go see those people. And that's it.
That's awesome.
That's it. That's all I have to do. So it's basically a year of kind of hanging out and reading things that I don't normally have time to read, and thinking about things that I don't normally have time to think about, and kind of getting the opportunity to not be stuck in the journalism deadline rat race for a little while.
That sounds great. What classes are you taking
I'm taking a
this
class.
semester?
I'm taking a fiction writing class, and I'm taking a drawing class, but the real, like, school thing is a class at the Kennedy School on science, politics, and power, which is really interesting and involves a lot of, 720-page papers full of sociology speak that we read through every week, but is becoming just this. Something I really am enjoying. I was kind of intimidated by it at first. It's been a really long time since I read that kind of academic literature. I'm used to reading science research, but this is very, very different language, very different format. But I feel like I'm really kind of getting an opportunity to sort of shift my perspective around a little bit, because I've been doing science blogging for, the last 5 years at Boing Boing. And the one thing that I feel a little bit frustrated about is that when you're kind of immersed in the science blogging community, you start to, start feeling like my job is to be this defender of science, and I will carry the standard, and I will tell people when they are wrong about things on the internet. And you just get into this cycle of, debunking stuff and responding to other things that people have out there, instead of getting a chance to really think about science in a critical way yourself. And so that's something I'm really enjoying with this class, is that it's kind of giving me an opportunity to think critically about science and think about the kind of stories I want to do in the future, and that's fantastic.
What do you mean by, I guess, think critically about science? I think that's really interesting because I mean, so what I read from that sort of literature about the sociology of science, often it does kind of cast a critical eye, but critical doesn't necessarily mean like negative, I guess.
Right,
it's
right.
Not,
no, yeah,
it's not
yeah.
what you would, yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's not what you would think of as like, when science bloggers talk about anti-science, you know, it's not that sort of criticism, right?
Right.
It's a much
right.
more nuanced kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it's not like, oh, science is all wrong. In fact, we actually spent the first class was actually talking, the professor is actually kind of sitting there spending an entire half a class period of 2 hours talking about, I don't actually believe in relativism and, you know, like, I do believe that there is truth. You can't actually find things through science. It's not like we're saying science is all wrong. But what we're really doing is sort of looking at it, what it's making me do anyway is rethink who the main characters of stories are and what the focus of my story should be. You know, like you kind of get caught up a little bit in thinking about I'm trying to figure out how the best way to word this because it's again, like you're right, it's not like saying science is bad or science is wrong, but it is sort of talking more about like how science fits into things in our culture and how science is influenced by things in our culture and how maybe we want to question the spaces where those things overlap because there might be stuff that scientists are missing or that science journalists are missing because we are so caught up in what we think is normal that we forget to ask whether this is actually normal or not. One of the things that we read this last week that was really interesting was this sort of deconstruction of the Africa exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History, you know, the original shot by Teddy Roosevelt kind of elephants and stuff like that. And it was really fascinating because it's an old paper from the 80s, so it's before they did a lot of remodeling over there, but it is looking at these original displays and talking about the history of what went into them and the messages that they were really explicitly meant to convey if you go back and read the writing of the curators that put them together. And there's this idea that they're really about showing you what real animal life is like, and also that there's this kind of underlying thing about what it takes to be a real man, that you go and have these adventures outside of your soft modern society and you shoot things and like that's how you connect with nature and become a real man. And it was interesting in that she was really showing you in this paper all of this incredible quantity of artifice that went into showing us what should have been just the obvious reality, right? Like, so you have, here is what real animals look like in their native habitats and in their, you know, native family groupings. And in order to show you this real, ostensibly real thing, you had all of these people crossing an ocean and then very specifically choosing specimens of animals to kill. Like, you know, they were stalking around different elephants for weeks because they wanted the one elephant that they felt was the Platonic ideal of elephants so that they could have that in the exhibit and not just any elephant. And then they're grouping these animals not necessarily based on how the animals actually lived in the wild, but on what they at the time thought family groupings were supposed to be. So some of these original setups had animals that were not really, you know, animals that didn't really live in patriarchal family setups, set into patriarchal family setups, because how else would a family be put together? And it was also interesting, like the conventions of what they were expecting to get out of it for themselves and like the making of a man sort of thing that they were really interested in at that time was also kind of highly constructed. So you had the story about George Eastman, the inventor of Kodak, went with this curator and several other people out on one of these expeditions and wrote later about like this adventure that he had and how it really made him feel connected to nature and it really made him feel like he had done something important. And it was this adventure of getting charged by an elephant that he was taking a photo of. But in order for him to have that adventure, he had to have this whole crew of black men who were not even called men, who were called boys in the texts of what he was writing, who had to shoot the elephant that was charging him while he was taking its photo. You know, just all of these things that you have to have to – all these things that had to have – that had to happen so that you could get this idea of what was real being put in front of you.
It was such
an interesting thing. Yeah.
I think that's what's been really interesting. That's what's fascinating to me when I read the texts like that. And what I definitely try and think about when, what you were saying about what you want to add into your science stories, is kind of like the work that it takes to make the facts seem obvious, I guess. Like what is it that it takes to see those and to make them sort of apparent to other people too? And the fact that it's work and it takes work doesn't mean that it's not true, or that, you know, that it's not good science, but it's always takes this work. And that work can be kind of like political as well as like technical. So actually, for the Museum of Natural History, I haven't read that article, but I'm editing right now an article by somebody who's writing about the Biological Facts Committee. So the Museum of Natural History in the 20s had created this committee called the Biological Facts Committee to kind of do exactly what you're talking about. I don't know if they mentioned it in the article.
No, but it was like, I haven't seen that.
But it was like to try and get the curators to like think about how to present facts to their kind of their public and what it meant to be a fact and what it meant to be biology. So like biology as a field of study was still pretty new and still kind of like forming around a lot of ideas around, you know, living things and how they work in ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And so definitely like, yeah, thinking about how to place things in relation to each other and say like how these organisms are like in nature. That takes a lot of work and all of these kinds of committee members angling and kind of like, there's a lot of politics where, you know, the fish curator is mad about something versus the, you know, African mammals curator is wants it one way and the other way. And so it's really interesting to kind of get that history to see when it's being made.
Oh, yeah, that's really
see that
interesting.
All in action.
Yeah. The other interesting thing that I'm taking away from this is also, like, thinking differently about other people's motivations. So, like, one of the other papers that we read was talking about sort of conceptions of power and how people associate or have associated in the past different technologies with specific types of political systems or specific types of power hierarchies. And this was not something I'd really thought much about before, because it's not something that I particularly do, but the way that they were explaining sort of how in some people's minds nuclear research of any kind, like, you know, nuclear power, nuclear weapons, had become associated with really hierarchical, very authoritarian government systems, and that there was this assumption that you could not possibly even do that kind of research without an authoritarian government system to kind of manage it, was just this was a real revelation to me in terms of thinking about how other people think about things, because I had not really ever conceived of it that way. And it made me sort of understand a little bit more of, you know, why there might be fear associated with nuclear power in some ways that I don't associate fear with nuclear power. Because if you're thinking of it as really heavily linked to an authoritarian power structure, well, that adds like this layer of, you know, unspoken ideas about this technology. And like that's a really interesting thing to me, because it makes me want to kind of go back a little bit and look at how I have written about science and movements of anti-science in the past and think a little bit more differently about where the people that I disagree with are coming from, because sometimes it might not, you know, what they say and what they're actually feeling might not actually be the same thing, which was interesting to me. And it was also interesting to, like, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just, I was going to sort of jump off from there. Well, we'll see how it goes. I've been thinking about this a lot because I think it's definitely easy what you're saying about debunking and this kind of, this tendency we have in science in general and in science blogging in particular, to kind of paint all kind of activist or sort of all things that are kind of against a particular kind of science as anti-science and lumping them all together.
Right.
So whether it's like people who are anti-vaccine, people who are anti-GMO, people who might be anti-nuclear power, people who are, you know, skeptical of the of any kind of climate change, for example, or, you know, climate change deniers or evolution deniers. Like all of those people are lumped together when we're talking about these sorts of things. But I think each group has very, very different motivations and they tell different kinds of stories about what it is that they're particularly interested in or distrusting of and what their own culture, what they bring to the story through their own culture, whether it's you know, a religious argument, whether it's a political argument, whether it's an economic argument, whether it's something about sort of self-determination or skepticism of various kinds of things. But they're all very, very different from each other. But I think we got this tendency to lump them together, I think kind of limits the conversations that we can have. And it also makes it hard for scientists and science writers, I think, to have that critical perspective, like that I can't, like that you can, you know, that you can support genetic engineering technology. So my background, my PhD is in genetic engineering, basically. But it doesn't mean that I wholeheartedly support every policy that's ever happened related to GMOs,
So
that I can still be skeptical, even though I support the technology sort of in theory, and I support sort of doing the research. So it's sort of hard to have a more nuanced position when you have like this, you're either with us or against us kind of angle.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, and one of the other things that occurred to me was that like when we're not questioning what assumptions we're bringing to that all to that conversation, also, I think that it can end up, you know, you miss important things that you don't really even know to pay attention to. So like the other thing that I thought was interesting about this is that this paper was written in the early 1980s and this researcher was giving examples of, you know, technologies that require, you know, according to him, required hierarchical power structures in order to function. And he gave the example of an airplane, which is so fascinating because since that paper came out, that's changed entirely.
Interesting.
You know, when that paper was published, you had this idea that of the strong captain, that you had to have, the captain was in charge of everything. Everybody had to listen to him. His word was law. His word was God, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Tenerife disaster. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. It's like the...
I don't know that.
It's the largest loss of life of any plane crash that ever happened. You had a foggy day in Tenerife and two huge airliners. I mean, you know, like upwards of like 300 people on each airliner. One of them was taking off and took off on the wrong runway and crashed into another one, and both... like 100% loss of life on both planes. And a big part of why that happened was because the captain on the plane that went down the wrong runway, he turned onto the wrong runway. He turned onto that and it became clear when you listened to the black boxes that some of the other people in the crew knew he might have made a mistake or thought he might have made a mistake, but didn't feel like they could question him because of the way that was set up. And so in the aftermath of that, the structure of how power works in airplane cockpits has totally changed. And today it's done in a much more, you know, the captain is still in charge, but there's a much more first among equals kind of thing happening. And so people are much more encouraged to question the captain when they think the captain needs to be questioned. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things that is credited with, you know, reducing airline crashes a huge amount in the last 30 years. So it was really interesting to me to go to read this paper from 1980 that's citing, you know, well, everybody knows that an airline has to have a hierarchical power structure in order to function. And mm-hmm. that just kind of made me think about, you know, when I am thinking about technology and how technology works, and I'm thinking about science and how science works, if I'm just mm-hmm. assuming that the way we do it is the way that we have to do it, what interesting stories am I missing that could, you know, could be really important if I don't question mm-hmm. myself and if I don't question what I think is normal?
That's so interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's definitely how, like, how it changed for me when I started reading stuff like that, which I think I call it sort of my science studies awakening that happened sort of when I was a graduate student, because I started reading these things and yeah, it really made me question, what we as scientists bring to our experiments, what we, you know, yeah, what are our, what does our position and our kind of like existence as human beings, how does that affect the way that we think about science and the way that we do science? And that's definitely really, really important. So I think for like the some really interesting examples and the kind of easiest for me to kind of understand and that where it really became apparent was when you think about gender, and how the science of gender, has sort of played out over history. So there's a great article called The Egg and the Sperm from the early 90s by Emily Martin. Have you read it?
Mm-mm.
It's a really, really interesting article because she basically just looks, she looks at textbooks about sort of reproductive biology, and sort of the language that people use, the metaphors that we use when we're talking about the eggs and sperms, in reproduction. So, this was obviously written in 1991, so things might be a little bit different now, but, she kind of saw, you know, there's a story of the kind of shy egg waiting for the sperm to come and like, just like sort of very passive egg, and very active sperm, and the sperm like piercing through the egg and, you know, this very kind of like masculine, obviously, traits kind of projected onto the sperm and very feminine, quote unquote, feminine traits onto the more passive egg. And those kinds of metaphors really are persistent like through all this literature and textbooks, to the extent that it made it very, very difficult to actually do research on the egg and the sperm
to
understand that like the egg has actually a very active role in fertilization, which in there's like, you know, the egg will grab onto the sperm and like pull it in. And there's all, you know, all these really interesting things about sort of the point at which they meet and the kinds of the protein structures there. Usually, you know, like the active and passive role in those pairings of those proteins in normal cells, like not sex related cells, is reversed when we talk about egg and sperm. So like the one that would be active in normal cells is on the egg. But when people were doing the research, they like flipped it around because they couldn't kind of imagine or couldn't conceptualize the egg as active.
Well, and isn't there
like really actually held back research?
Well, isn't there like the really active role that the egg plays in making sure that it's not being fertilized by like, you know, 15,000 different sperm at once, right? Like there's a whole electric. Is it electric or mm-hmm. like the field that kind of ends up hardening the egg
remember.
Afterwards? Yeah. But like, yeah, like that's really, yeah. that's so fascinating that what you consider these norms that you sort of extrapolate onto things that are, don't actually reflect them, but that you assume must mm-hmm. because, well, duh, you know?
Yeah. There's also, also in developmental biology, there's an article by, a professor at MIT named Evelyn Fox Keller called Developmental Biology as a Feminist Cause, where she kind of talks again similarly like that research in developmental biology, like because we kept imagining sort of the starting point for development as fertilization, as the kind of activating of the egg by the sperm, they totally missed all of the interesting things that were happening in the egg before fertilization.
Oh, really?
So the egg actually has a structure to it and has a kind of has a gradient sort of and a process where after fertilization, a lot of the initial body plan, at least in fruit flies where it was first kind of figured out, the body plan is kind of determined by how the egg was kind of structured. And so that process used to be called delayed effects, like when there were things that were happening in the egg that showed up later in development, they called it delayed effects. But eventually they realized it was a maternal effect, that it was something in the egg itself. So that was really interesting, to see, like, how does the way that we think about these things shape how we understand them, how we make more knowledge about them.
God, that's really fascinating. Well, so tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing right now, because you were in California and now you're kind of back in Boston for a little while. What are you working on right now?
Well, I'm all over the place. I'm currently in New York.
Oh, okay.
But I'm working on many different projects, all sort of related to science and media and design and education. So it's sort of hard to explain all of them. But one thing I'm doing is I'm starting a new blog and sort of online magazine, which I'm hoping is going to be stories sort of like this, science as it's being made. Not just telling you the story of like a fact and, you know, how great it is and how it's going to cure cancer or save the world, the sort of discovery model of science communication, but more in the process. What is the... you know, what is it that we think about when we're thinking about science? How are we making the science happen in the lab? What are those stories of things still being uncovered? What happens when we're uncertain and we're still trying to figure things out? So sort of talking about the scientific method in process and the different kinds of scientific methods that we have.
Oh, interesting.
So one of the articles is the one about the Biological Facts Committee. I also have a great, I did an interview with Evelyn Fox Keller, who's the professor, and sort of talking about her career and how she went from, she started her career as a theoretical physicist. She did her PhD in the 1950s, and then she ended up doing molecular biology and mathematical biology. But then eventually she also had this kind of awakening herself when she realized that she couldn't really talk just about the science. She also had to talk about how her experience as a woman in science also really mattered and changed the kind of science that she was sort of able to do because it changed the way that people thought about her and the way, you know, the way that gender plays out in science was affecting the way that the science was being done. So she ended up sort of becoming a historian and a philosopher of science. Writing a lot of books about gender and about metaphor and language and how those words that we use when we talk about science actually affect the way that we think about the facts and the way that we make new science. So it was really fascinating to talk to her. And so I have a little interview with her too.
What was an example of how that affected her career and like the work that she did?
Well, so I mean, back in the 60s and 70s, there was obviously like just very blatant discrimination against women. She really struggled during her PhD trying to sort of convince people that she could do physics, that she was actually doing it and she wasn't getting like a boyfriend to help her with her homework, sort of like at the, like the, that sort of very basic level. But then more and more she ended up doing a lot of research, talking to other scientists and realizing that, there's a belief in science among scientists that science is a masculine way of thinking. Very rational, right? Like we're rational. We have this very like objective view of the world. And by definition then, like this kind of feminine, like quote unquote feminine approach was not scientific.
Right.
And so, like, that kind of plays out in all sorts of different ways. But it changes the way that it affects many different things within science. It affects the scientists themselves who have to kind of you know, maintain this idea of rationality and kind of keep it moving and not allow themselves to be emotional. Mm-hmm. And it affects the women sort of directly by sort of saying, oh, well, you know, you're probably not very good at science because you're a woman kind of approach. But it was interesting, actually, there's an example that's not quite, it's not quite like the same as what she was talking about, but I just wrote an article about the science of nail polish. And something that you think of as like feminine and girly and kind of silly and cosmetic, you don't think of it as a very scientific thing and a thing that would have kind of science related to it. But the chemistry of nail polish is actually like super hardcore. And it's like polymer chemistry, and the same kinds of polymers that make the gel nail polish are used in orthopedic surgery as bone cement.
Oh, that's really cool.
You know, there's this super fascinating sort of chemical process that happens when you make nail polish. There's a really long history of the molecules and the chemicals that we use in nail polish that are used in all sorts of other things. But because we kind of associate nail polish with femininity, we don't think about it as good or scientific. The same day that my article came out, there was an article about a science museum, I don't know where it was, but they had, for the Girl Scouts, one of the kind of activities that the Girl Scouts could do was the science of sparkle. And so learn about cosmetic chemistry. And there was a very negative and critical article saying, like, I can't believe it. Why can't girls just do normal science? Why do they have to do girl science? With the underlying assumption being that, like, things that are girly are not science.
That's interesting, because that's kind of, like, my initial thought also is, like, oh, my God, seriously, fucking makeup science? that's an interesting point. There's a couple of the papers that I was reading for my Science, Politics, and Power class that were also about, like, conceptions of what is masculine, what is feminine, and how that layers on top of science. And one of these things was citing this is like an old paper from the 70s, but it was citing a survey of British schoolboys who they found thought of scientists as both more masculine than non-scientist men, but also less sexual.
Weird.
Which I thought was really interesting, and it got me thinking a lot about, like, our conceptions of, you know, what is masculine, what is feminine, and really, like, made it seem, like, reading through this paper, it just kind of had one of those moments where I'm like, why is it not obvious to us that these things that we assign to gender are social in, you know, most cases, rather than actually biological? Because if you think about the things that get assigned to masculinity, they're often like totally conflicting, but they seem so right and natural. So if you think about, like, simultaneously, everybody knows that guys are way more sexual than women, and that guys are, you know, just out there having sex all the time and woo, really into it. But then at the same time, everybody knows that guys are much more rational than women and aren't swayed by their emotions in silly ways like, you know, you'd be swayed by the emotions of sex. And how are those two things simultaneously true? You know, the only way that that's simultaneously true is if you are having, you know, social ideas of what masculinity means layered on top of one another. So you're taking simultaneously this much, you know, this very ancient idea of from back in the day when, you know, medieval times when women were considered to be these crazy sexual monster beasts, you know, leeching.
That's what I was going to say. Over history, things are different.
Everything changes.
That's how you can see that it's social.
You can see the social from, like, how everything changes over history, but we end up, like, holding on to these conceptions still. You know, like, we simultaneously believe these totally opposing ideas and think of them as natural because we've just accumulated them instead of actually, like, really changing, which was just kind of an interesting thought that came out of reading that paper. So you get things like,
The natural, the idea of natural is really important and interesting and definitely part of when we're talking about science, because once it becomes science, then it becomes natural. It's a fact,
right? Yeah, exactly.
So, So, like, there's this way that science kind of will perpetuate these kinds of social ideas because scientists are human. We have these cultural ideas as humans, and they kind of get into our science, and then they just keep going because now they're natural. They're science. It's normal.
Right.
I mean, so you see it all the time, like, you know, there was an article in the Scientific American blogs a couple weeks ago, or like maybe a couple months ago, about how high heels are like naturally something that women might be interested in because it makes their legs look longer, and therefore, you know, evolutionary psychology says, you know, we'll have more babies that way. I don't even know, something like crazy like that, with no mention that high heels were first designed for men.
Right.
That there's this long history of, you know,
who also liked the long leg thing at the time. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So like, but that's science. So because evolution. So therefore you can't argue with it because it's just natural. It's just the way things are. Women like to have high heels. I don't know.
Girls are so into shoes. Aren't girls into shoes? Yeah. I wonder why that is.
Yeah.
We should do some science on that. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's do some science.
God.
I mean, it happens so much. It's sort of over and over again. And I think what's interesting is, yeah, like it's kind of easy, maybe too easy to pick apart. Like when you're talking about evolutionary psychology or when things like have an obvious social component.
Yeah.
I think it becomes much more challenging as you move it further and further away. But I think that these things still play a role.
Right.
And there are still kind of these human and cultural issues, even when we're talking about, you know, particle physics and things that don't seem like they have, you know, they don't seem like they have a social dimension,
right?
But they do because we're humans, and you know, we have kind of political concerns. You know, we're funded by the government, so we have to kind of think about how to get that money and what is happening, and we have kind of, you know, rivalries within our own lab and within other labs, and all of those things, you know, are part of the way that science is done. And it doesn't mean that science is wrong or bad, again.
Right.
But it just means that
science
to really
is a part
understand
of society.
Science.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and to really understand it and how, you know, what it does and what effect it's going to have, you have to look at that and think about it, too.
A couple of years ago...
You can't just pretend it doesn't exist.
This actually reminds me, like, a couple of years ago, I did a piece for Scientific American on this childhood development test that we do on, you know, babies and on also on animals, actually, because it's kind of a self-awareness thing. So, you know, you put like a dot on the subject's forehead and you put them in front of a mirror and you see at which point they realize that the dot on the head of the thing in the mirror is also on there, like that is them, you know.
Oh.
They make that conceptual leap, and it's it has been framed as a way of like understanding child development, that like there's a certain age where kids make that jump from not realizing that that's them to realizing that that's them, and then kind of used to help understand, you know, the intelligence of elephants or birds and chimpanzees. But then it turns out that most of that data on when kids are supposed to hit this point comes from, you know, basically just US and Western Europe. And when people started doing these studies in other places, the age that children did it changed. And it wasn't like drastically. So like you went from like, oh, everybody does it by 18 months to there's some 6-year-olds who aren't doing this. Why aren't those 6-year-olds doing this? Yeah. And it wasn't because the 6-year-olds were dumb. It wasn't because they didn't understand the difference between, you know, themselves and other things. It wasn't because they didn't know how mirrors worked. What the researchers were coming up with was that it had to do with social behaviors of, you know, how you raise children. So you're talking about going into a culture where there aren't a lot of mirrors. So you don't have children from the age of, you know, infancy sitting in front of it going, oh, is that you? Who's that? Who's that? Who's that? You know, like that doesn't just even happen. So this might have been the first mirror they ever saw. And then you also have this very different conception of what we expect from kids in terms of individual action. So we have a value when we raise kids in the US of we want them to be independent and we want them to kind of do things and then come back and ask us for explanations of those things. You know, like we want them to kind of take charge of their own little worlds. And that's not necessarily true for all cultures. So you have a lot of cultures where it would be really inappropriate for a kid to, like, even make this jump themselves without waiting for the adult to tell them that, oh, look at that, that's something you should pay attention to. And that made a huge difference in how the kids were interacting with this experiment that had been designed very specifically for one culture. And like that stuff is just so fascinating to me, because then, you know, then you have to start questioning, you know, how well we're actually getting information about animal intelligence through it. Because, you know, if human cultures respond differently to this test, well, you know,
what about animal cultures?
Right. You know, I mean, like, what's normal for the animal? I mean, culture might be like the wrong word in that case, but it's, you know, they have norms of their own, right? And they have behavioral norms and their own little societal norms. And maybe their norms don't line up with the norms that are embodied in this test. And so that's just another example of, you know, these things that you don't think of as being social or cultural that then turn out to be, and it just completely skews your data. So yeah, like that's just fascinating stuff to me.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I remember you were an anthropology major in college.
Yeah. Right?
Does that play a role, you think, in how you think about science, or like, yeah, how did you become a science writer and a science journalist being an anthropology major? What was the, like, did you think of anthropology, were you doing more like biological anthropology and science-y stuff, or more cultural
science? It wasn't really well planned. I went to college thinking I was going to do pre-med. And so like half the free world. Yeah. And I started doing biological anthropology because of that, because I, you know, I'd always found anthropology really interesting, and so that just seemed like a nice way to do pre-med without just having like a boring biology degree. And
it wasn't boring.
No, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I, like after 1 year of school, sort of realized that I wasn't totally sure I wanted to be a doctor, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I just kind of kept doing the anthropology, you know, the undergrad basic stuff, not really sure where I was going, and then kind of stumbled into a journalism class and realized that that was what I wanted to be doing. And then I had this double major thing happening, but the anthropology wasn't as important anymore. So I just started taking whatever I thought was interesting, which means I ended up with a mixture of classes that were, part of them are biological anthropology and part of them are Central and South American archaeology. So I have an anthropology degree that doesn't make sense in a, like, if I were actually going into academia, but, it was really fun and I learned a lot, and I kind of started thinking of journalism as applied anthropology in a lot of ways. So I think it shaped how it's definitely shaped my ability. You know, the fact that I knew how to read a scientific paper coming out of school was a big deal for me. And it's also shaped, I think, the way that I have kind of approached storytelling and approached interviewing subjects and like what questions I'm asking and, you know, what I'm paying attention to. But I think that's kind of the main way that it has shaped my work. And this
that's
is
really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is kind of like going back to that same kind of space and just kind of getting a maybe higher level of that or a reminder of that and kind of applying it onto my career, you know, 10 years, 11 years out of graduating.
That's great. I mean, I know a lot of anthropologists, and that definitely, like, the writing style is interesting. And like what you're talking about, like what you notice, I think what anthropologists notice is different than what I notice as somebody trained in science.
Yeah.
And so I like, that's why I like hanging out with them and I like sort of working with them. And also why I like working with artists. And I think artists also notice something different, when you're talking about anything. So like they sort of, yeah, they grab onto different things. They ask different questions than I would ask. And so I like being able to see things through different perspectives. And so I like working with them. And for me, so as a scientist, like as somebody who was, you know, did a lot of training in biology, when I started having this science studies awakening and I started seeing like how culture was important and how it was involved, I didn't necessarily see myself as like, you know, becoming a scholar of these things and mm-hmm. writing books about them. But I did want to have those kinds of questions play a role in the science that I did. Like, how could I do a different kind of science because I was being, because I had sort of seen and understood that, you know, our perspectives are incomplete and we have these kinds of social baggage when we're talking about doing science. And for me, I was doing sort of engineering and technology. And that's why I sort of ended up falling in with the artists and the designers. Because the designers, I think when a designer is thinking about a product that a human is going to use, and it's something that's going to be made and produced, you know, good designers are thinking about all of those different kinds of steps. You know, how much is it going to cost? Where is it going to be made? How is it going to be disposed of? How is it going to be used? And how might be used differently than what we expect it to be used as?
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh no, that's all. Go ahead.
I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to take this class is because I did some reporting over the last couple of years on socio-technical systems, and sort of starting to kind of these movements of trying to understand how technology and culture work together to shape each other. In this kind of, you know, giant writhing ball of snakes sort of model of the world. And it, I thought it was really interesting, like talking to some of those researchers about how often you get engineering that just fails entirely to take into account how people might use it. And then, well, that's the people's fault because they didn't understand the technology. You know, like there's a very interesting, like, the fact that you kind of have to explicitly remind people that this is a thing that you're making that then goes into a culture and you actually have to design this for people. You can't just design it because it's cool, you know. And it's one of the interesting things that we I watched a lecture yesterday that had absolutely nothing to do with science or any of this. It was Harvard has a do you know Harvard has a hip hop archive? Like, this is just incredibly awesome. Like, yeah, an actual hip hop archive. And this year they have the first Nasir Jones Fellowship in Hip Hop Studies, the NAS Fellowship. Yeah, super awesome. And I got to meet the NAS Fellow, and he gave a talk yesterday about how hip hop has had a huge role in shaping democratic politics, you know, democracy and elections in Senegal. And oh dear, I may have lost my train of thought on this. Now I remember. Okay, sorry. But part of what he, like, just offhandedly in this lecture, he mentioned that there's been like all of this building development in Senegal in like the last 10 years, like lots of big apartment buildings and, you know, fancy developments kind of put in. And those architects have totally failed to take into account how people, like how traditional culture in Senegal works and how families want to live. And so he had some of his sources, you know, his ethnographic sources were complaining about, you know, we got this new apartment building, but the apartments are only big enough that you could maybe have four people live in them, which really changes our family structure in a place where you're used to having grandparents and extended family members be a part of the family that you live with. And it also totally changes the way that communities operate, because you're going from a lot of people who are moving into these apartment buildings are coming from these rural communities where not only do people not lock their doors, but there are not doors. So there, you know, you, it's totally normal for you to just like go wander into the neighbor's house and say, hey, and all of a sudden you're in an apartment.
It's like a college.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And all of a sudden you're in an apartment building that the door is shut and you're only there with like your nuclear family and you don't have access to everybody else in your building, and how depressing and cut off you would suddenly feel in that space. And it just, it reminded me of everything. You know, my husband is an architect, and it reminded me of everything when he was in architecture school. He would come home and just constantly complain that that was a field where you were being taught to do sculpture, and people would figure out how to live in your sculpture. That was their problem, you know? Like, there wasn't that emphasis on actually understanding how people are going to use this thing, and whether you're building something that is designed for the people it's being designed for. Like that, that's just such a huge thing that, you know, it seems so obvious, but, you know, we often fail completely to take it into account.
It's hard to do.
Oh, it is really hard to do. Yeah. It takes a lot more work.
Yeah. It takes a lot more work. And I think for, it's certainly coming from different perspectives, right? And people have different kind of opinions of this. But, like, if you have an idea that, like, oh, this is the way to live, like, this is technology works, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, this, it's this way. Like, there's a kind of, like, rational way of doing things.
Right.
You know, like, you know, oh, obviously people live like this. So, like, it, you know, you don't.
Why would I question that?
This is what they want. Why would you want anything different? Like, this is going to, you know, fit this many people in this much space. It's going to be great, you know. I guess there's a lot of assumptions that go into making any new technology or any new thing. You know, you could drive yourself crazy thinking about all of your unquestioned assumptions.
Right, yeah, yeah. I know. And that's, like, the hard part is, like, where does that stop? Like, at what point are you just kind of devolve into, like, have you ever really looked at your hand? You know, there's there's a line, right? But
yes. But I think, this is something that I think about a lot in my teaching. Like, when I teach engineers, like, how much do you need to kind of, like, push them on this kind of, like, path of being, like, reflective and like thinking about those things, and how much do you push them so far that they fall off? So, like, when I first started kind of, my first awakening, I didn't think I could finish my PhD. I was like, oh, how am I doing this? I'll never be able to, you know, do science that's really objective. I was still hanging on to it. I was like, oh no, like, it's impossible. I'll never be able to, like, do good science because look at all these things that people, like, look at how bad it could turn out. You know, like, maybe science is just hopeless. but I think,
like, worrying about the outcomes of the technology you're making, or, like, you mean?
Thinking that you're hoping that you're going to make something good and lasting and wanting to do good work and good work that is kind of, like, objective and will stand the test of time, and people won't look at it 100 years later and be like, wow, can you believe what they thought back then? I had this real crisis though of not feeling comfortable, like, contributing to that and, like, how can I do something that's good? And I think partly what it took to get beyond it is to say, you know, it can't be perfect. And just thinking about it is good. And bringing it up when I can, being like, maybe we should think about this. it was enough. And I think, and the artists helped a lot. they thought about it all the time, too. I think, that's the thing. Like, you have to make something, and it's not going to be perfect. So you have to also keep... you have to keep at it and keep checking back in and making sure that you're evolving and adapting and figuring things out and talking to people and talking to a lot of people when you're making things, not just talking to people who look like you and think like you and are other engineers. That's the other thing too, I think. And that's something that is hard to do. I think what you said at the very beginning, how, you know, when you read these articles, that you have to kind of learn a new language to see things from the perspective of somebody who's trained in a very different kind of scholarly tradition. And so I think that you constantly have to learn new languages to talk to new kinds of people, and to learn more about what you're doing and where it's going to yeah, how it's going to be and where, you know, how it's going to adapt in different environments and in different contexts.
Well, and I think it makes,
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, like I think it totally makes sense because like I'm having that experience. Like, say I'm taking a drawing class and I don't draw. I do stick people. But like all of a sudden, like two classes, this teacher is amazing. Like this old lady who like figure skates and is this incredible drawing teacher. But she like in two classes has got me drawing human figures that look like actual human figures. I have no idea how it worked. Like I had to post it on Facebook last week. Cause like, ah, look, I drew a person. That looks like a person. But that process.
I don't think we're friends on Facebook.
Oh,
I need to,
we should be. Cause you have to, you have to see
friends
this.
So I can
it's
see
amazing.
Your drawing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like it was really interesting to me because it made me think in a totally different way, both about what artists do and about what I do. Because it, you know, she started out having us do these kind of capturing the line of motion in a in a model. So like, you know, the model's posed and you're just making a line that kind of traces the movement, you know, the here's one arm kind of down to the next arm, here's the head down to a leg. And you just keep doing these lines of movement, each, you know, a different line of movement. And eventually, like, the shape of a body kind of starts to appear out of the other as you do this. And all of a sudden, you actually have this thing. And it occurred to me, like, a couple of things occurred to me out of that. And one of them was that when you're doing art like this, it's not that you are trying to sit there and like really realistically like draw every tiny little detail. You're trying to draw something that fools somebody's eye into thinking you have done that. And that, that which it never really occurred to me before, but like then it just it's an optical illusion in a lot of ways, and I hadn't really quite thought of it that way.
Interesting.
And it also just sort of made me think about like how I do journalism and, you know, you just taking these little lines, these questions, and each little question kind of starts to build up this whole thing that eventually, you know, you never quite get exactly to truth, but you get to something that looks like truth if you kind of stand far away and cross your eyes and look at it, right? So
it's an interesting metaphor for doing science.
Yeah,
too,
tracing
the like following the lines of that of movement where they take you, like finding the right, you know, finding a question that you can grab onto and kind of following it and putting things together and building your narrative of what's happening, you know, whether it's inside the cell or inside an atom or whatever it is, through these pieces of experiments that kind of give you a picture of the truth that you have.
Oh, that's interesting. So we're almost, I guess, kind of right about...
It's been about an hour.
About an hour. So are we good?
Yeah. I think so.
Excellent.
This was really interesting.
Yeah, this
it's
has been really cool.
To talk to you.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I would love if we can do more of these.
Yeah.
So cool. Thanks a lot for, for
Thank
chatting.
You. Yeah, thanks. This was fun. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.